Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Australian-born feminist icon Germaine Greer made her mark loud and early with her manifesto, The Female Eunuch, in 1970. Bold, beautiful, outspoken, she went right on critiquing the world around us and before us as a Renaissance scholar. Anne Hathaway caught her eye, Shakespeare's wife, tarred for centuries as conniving, unfaithful, a harpy. Wrong, says Germaine Greer, and that's not all she has to say. This hour, On Point, Germaine Greer on Anne Hathaway and the world right now. You can join the conversation. What's your question for Germaine Greer on feminism, our times, the 16th century's Anne Hathaway? Germaine Greer joins me now from New York. Her book, The Female Eunuch, was a seminal text for the feminist movement of the 1970s. She's a scholar of Elizabethan drama, professor emeritus with the University of Warwick, with a slew of titles to her name. Her book, Shakespeare's Wife, came out in the U.S. last year. It's now out in paperback. Germaine Greer, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's kind of incredible to have you as a guest. I don't know if you get that often, but I remember those 1970s, and you were so big and so prominent. And I have to admit, I haven't really kept close track since then. Are you still, calling for revolution?
I don't think I'm exactly calling for revolution. I was never really much of an activist. I was always more a writer who wrote about issues that seemed to me important then, and I still write about them now. I don't have an opportunity to write regularly about matters affecting women. And one of the things I've been trying to do just recently is get the BBC, the national broadcaster in Britain, interested in a proper series about women called A Century of Women, which would actually look at what happened to women in the 20th century, where we started off from and where we got to, that would begin with kind of broad categories, wives, mothers, girls, whatever, and then move out and out until we got to women in engineering, women in science, women working on building sites, women on conductors on trains and buses, whatever, that just look at how many steps forward were taken and how many steps back.
That sounds great. If I were to ask you to just look at your active segment of that, the part you were directly involved in from the 1970s until now, how would you describe the progress or lack of progress, expectations in 1970 when the Female Eunuch came out and where we are today?
Well, I was never an equality feminist because I thought equality was a completely conservative aim, which took the current situation of men as the best that women could aspire to, which for me would have been a doctrine of despair. So I was always talking about freedom and self-determination. Women certainly have been incorporated in the workforce much more now, say, than there were 50 years ago. But that has also been the time when the power of labor has been completely undermined and probably destroyed. So we have women in the workforce, but we have an extremely vulnerable workforce. Also, it seems that women are still doing by far the greater part of unpaid work outside the paid workplace, and that the majority of unpaid workers worldwide in agriculture and so on will turn out to be female. Some things have yet to change. And you could argue that as the gap between rich and poor has grown wider, poverty has been feminized and it's become intractable. One of the frightening things about the collapse of the Western financial empire is that it will be the people at the bottom of the food chain who are going to be ground hardest and who have least room to maneuver. We're still trying to figure out who's losing jobs faster. But if we look at, say, light bulb factories in the Philippines or Malaysia, we'll probably see that the women are being laid off, and these are women who are supporting extended families.
There's a kind of economic political analysis. The Female Eunuch, way back in 1970, also had a lot to do with personal, internal politics. Women as sort of As self-castrated in a way, also pushed by society, but cut off from a lot of their own power internally in their own psyche. When you look at young women today, do you still see that pattern being replicated or something new, Jamingra?
It depends a bit where you look. I mean, an example that I think about a lot is I had a student who had decided that she wasn't ready for penetrative sex. And so she had a boyfriend for years and years who finally left her because he considered that she was holding out on him. She then was rooming with other women while she was studying, and they all had regular boyfriends who visited regularly. Mm. And one day they were discussing female orgasm. And she was reading out a description from a book, and she realized that these women were staring at her. They said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? Mm. And she realized that even though these women were sexually active all the time, it was required of them, it was part of their culture, and she was the standout, she was the weird one,
right,
that they were actually getting less pleasure than she was. And I was really interested in that as an example of her independence. But then she said to me that she couldn't, that guys kept dumping her. And I said, well, what do you mean they keep dumping you? And she says, well, you know, you're at a party on campus and you're getting on really nicely with somebody. And he says, you know, shall we go home? Mm-hmm. And she then says, well, I have to tell you that I don't do penetrative sex. Mm. And he walks away. And I said, but honey, that's not being dumped. You know, that's not being considered at all.
And this isn't just about dating or just about how far we go. I mean, in the female eunuch, you pointed to sexuality as a core source of power, the way it's handled or not handled, the way it's owned or not owned.
Well, it's actually essential to your self-determination that you understand your own sexuality and that you recognize your own sexual needs and desires and that you don't just respond to somebody else's scenario. But it still looks as if women, I mean, if we take something like Sex in the City, which I found incredibly depressing to watch.
Because?
Because the women were all focused on their relationships with men.
Mm-hmm.
Their relationship with each other was important, and that was a positive. And lots of young women will say to you now that their girlfriends are of major importance to them. And I would hope what that means is when they do get married or pair up with somebody or take out a mortgage, which is the real binding thing these days, that they would still hang on to their girlfriends. But my observation is that they don't.
In all this, with everything going on, at the same time, you're a Renaissance scholar, you're deep in Elizabethan drama, and your attention was pulled back to Anne Hathaway, and not the Anne Hathaway, who's very much in American movies these days, but Shakespeare's wife. What took your eye, your interest back there, Jermaine Greer?
Well, the thing is, I have always worked on Shakespeare's early comedies since I was a graduate student at Cambridge. And what I tried to argue then was that Shakespeare's attitude to marriage was not a cliché. It became a cliché afterwards, you know, the wooing and wedding happiness story. But it wasn't then, and he virtually invented it. And it came out of the Protestant ferment about raising the status of marriage to be the highest state of life for an adult man, as distinct from celibacy or compromised celibacy or whatever. Mm. And I accumulated a vast mass of material, popular literature, folk tales, polemics on either side from the Catholics and from the Protestants. And I showed all this to my supervisor, and she said, but Jermaine, this is not literature. This is history. You won't get your PhD if you write about this. And I thought, oh, well, that's a lot of time wasted. And I then went along to the Cambridge Demographic Study Group and said, can I give you a paper on the ideology of marriage in the 16th century? And Peter Lazlitt, the late, great Peter Lazlitt, said to me, well, no, actually. And I said, well, why? Why wouldn't you want to hear it? He said, because we're only interested in what people were really doing and not what people were saying. And I said, yes, but the actual existence of a polemic is an event in itself, and it wouldn't hurt you to know about it. In later years, we became very good friends, and Peter said that in retrospect, that was a mistake. But I still had all this stuff inside me, this big chunk of stuff that I'd never found a way of explaining. And I kept, at one stage, I sort of tried to map it out in a book, and I even designed the cover and everything, and I thought, nah.
Was this the rescue mission for Anne Hathaway at that point?
Well, no. You see, what happened then was I caught a plane to Australia just about the time when Will in the World came out.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Greenblatt's book.
Right.
And it was the only thing I could find to read. I hate reading biographies of Shakespeare for obvious reasons. And I grabbed it and read it on the plane, and I got into such a state. I thought, why on earth, Stephen, when you have no evidence for it whatsoever, why do you want me to believe that Shakespeare loathed his wife?
That she was unfaithful, conniving, trapped him into marriage.
He didn't say any of that.
But this is the kind of the mythology, at least, right?
It's a bit of it. That's a very early part of it. Mm-hmm. We started off with a beautiful wife who was unfaithful. Then they found out the thing that meant she couldn't possibly be beautiful, and that was that she was 8 years older than Shakespeare. That meant that she had to be a bag. Mm-hmm. She had to be hideous.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing they found out, oh, shock, was that she was pregnant when they got married. And that's when her stocks completely crumbled.
And in his will, she's given the second best bed, famously.
Well, yes, that's true. And it's a dreadful will. And the only way to explain it probably is by reference to the marriage settlement for Susanna Shakespeare and her husband John Hall, which made them both heirs to their parents, to their fathers, so that they were sole heirs and that the two fortunes were going to be amalgamated.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with feminist icon Germaine Greer about her take on William Shakespeare's much-maligned wife, Anne Hathaway, and her bigger take on the world right now, on women and their place in our world, almost 40 years after she wrote The Female Eunuch. Germaine Greer joins us from New York. And, Germaine, I wonder if you would mind if we listened to just a little bit of the 1999 film Shakespeare in Love. I'm sure you know it. Young William Shakespeare, played by Joseph Fiennes, laments that he's lost his ability to write, and his advisor, Dr. Moth, played here by Anthony Scher, suggests that young Will might find his muse through sexual conquest.
You have a wife, children?
I was a lad of 18. Anne Hathaway was a woman half as old again.
A woman of property.
She had a cottage. One day she was 3 months gone with child, sir.
And your relations?
On my mother's side, the Ardens.
No, your marriage bed.
4 years and 100 miles away in Stratford. A cold bed, too, since the twins were born. Banishment was a blessing.
So now you are free to love.
You cannot love nor write it.
From Shakespeare in Love, 1999, Germaine Greer. So is that the myth or the basic outlines of it as it's sort of popularly out there?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it as it stands, except that we don't know that Shakespeare ever really abandoned Stratford. He may have returned every year, especially during Lent when the theatres were closed. There's an odd thing about the fact that he writes his plays alone that is rare in the playwriting setup. It's a bit like writing an episode of Friends alone. And I think that suggests he did write in seclusion, and that the most likely place to do that was in Stratford. And it's also important to remember that Shakespeare came home at the end of his career back to New Place. Also, we shouldn't forget that somehow they acquired New Place and that Shakespeare never acquired property in London. He always lived in lodgings. That doesn't sound like a man who's abandoned his wife and children. I don't know why my colleagues are so anxious to claim that he did do that. It doesn't do him any credit if he did.
But you describe it in the book, Shakespeare's wife, as part of a pattern sort of from time immemorial. You say, until our own time, history focused on man the achiever. The higher the achiever, the more likely it was that the woman who slept in his bed would be judged unworthy of his company.
Yes, particularly in literature. The misogynistic tradition is still alive and well in Cambridge. There are still Cambridge colleges where you may not invite your wife to dine on high table if you're a fellow. that you can ask other people, but you can't ask the woman who cleans the toilet.
And so the sort of standard issue story about Anne versus your version here, Germaine Greer, what's the picture you've pulled out? And we have to say there's a lot that can't be known. You've had to look at the mores of that time, of living style and patterns, and sort of project yourself into what might have been here. But what do you see?
Well, first of all, the book is written in the conditional all the way through. This mm-hmm. is a very difficult thing to do, to talk about what the possibilities are. What I'm giving you is a series of guesses. I never conceal the fact that they are guesses, but what I'd like people to consider is that they're better guesses than the others. For example, Elizabethan women all worked. Anne Hathaway wouldn't have been sitting around waiting for her husband. She was probably at work somewhere, either on her parents' farm or else on someone else's farm, or else in industry, since she was 11 or 12 years old. And this changes your whole perception of what's going on. We haven't got a situation like the beginning of Pride and Prejudice, with a lot of girls sitting around looking for husbands. That's not how Elizabethan society works.
So work maybe brewing ale, you suggest? Or maybe
no, that's later on, when okay. she's a householder. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But she may have done those things when she was an unmarried woman as well. But there was actually a job description, housekeeper, and it was a very highly qualified job, because there are plenty of men out there who'd lost their wives, who died in childbirth, say, or whose wives were young and inexperienced and couldn't run a big household, especially a second wife, for example, and they would need to take a housekeeper, a man who was going up to London every term to work in the courts of law or in Parliament or in any of the other institutions that followed the system, would actually need a housekeeper to send him food from the country, to send him his clean clothes, mm-hmm. to keep him sorted out, to keep his house for him. And that was one job she might have had. The least likely thing is that she had no job at all.
But the job issue is important because you see her not as a drag on William Shakespeare, but as a supporter.
Well, if he can go to London to try his poetry, he needs to have a wife who can take care of herself. And we've got a woman here who's got a toddler and has born twins. She's managed to keep the twins alive. For me, that means that this is a woman of resource, a strong woman. She's got to get breastfeeding established for two babies, one of whom I think, Hamnet, was probably carrying some sort of a birth injury. Twin confinements were very dangerous at the time. When I looked at the parish registers, I could see just what the death toll was amongst twins when they were newborns, and also amongst the mothers who very often went into the ground within a few days of a multiple birth.
So a woman of resources, or at least resourcefulness.
And physical strength, I think.
What about the pairing of these two in the first place? I mean, she's often presented as having sort of trapped him into marriage. What's your Germaine Greer interpretation?
It's going to look funny, isn't it, if she wasn't even in Stratford? And it looks as if she wasn't, because they weren't married in Stratford. And normally you get married in the bride's parish. Mm. So where did she get married from? Was she working in a great house somewhere? She was married in the chapel of the great house. We just don't know. We haven't got that piece of information. But one reason why we haven't got it is that we never looked for it, because we weren't really interested. My male colleagues didn't really care. They didn't want Anne Hathaway to become a real person. She may have been a woman of property. It looks as if her brother was a man of property. Her brother was a church warden, which in Stratford, he was church warden at Holy Trinity. That means he earned, he had profits of £50 a year, which is enormous. And he was doubly literate. He could read and write. And that's her brother. So I think we ought to consider that until we find out who Anne's mother is and what that's all about, we don't really know if she was Portia of Belmont. You know, we don't know if she was a great catch. Certainly Shakespeare at 18 years old, with a father who was broke and hiding from his creditors and terrified of the law, certainly Shakespeare wasn't a catch. She's the one who threw herself away on a boy, and she was the right age to be married. He was the wrong age. He was too young.
There's a bit in The Twelfth Night, you write, where the young Cesario is sent out to woo the daughter of a count, and he is younger, it appears, from Shakespeare's text, and very ardent in wooing this
older woman, make me a willow cabin at your gate and call upon my soul within the house. I mean, he's really reaching out to her. What about Shakespeare's own work?
The association.
What does it tell us?
Well, it tells us that, well, if you think of the seven ages of man, the lover making a sonnet to his mistress eyebrow comes straight after the schoolboy and before night service, which is done when you're 21. So it's a teenager. We also know that teenagers are very highly sexed. The thing about it is the Elizabethans don't confuse themselves on that issue. They're very aware of the fact that boys think about sex an awful lot. But also it's the time when they are most attractive. When they're on the cusp of manhood, when they have just a light beard, when their voice is hardly broken, and when they're full of the animal spirits of youth. And so again and again in Shakespeare's plays, especially the comedies, the men appear much younger than the women. I mean, psychologically much younger. If you think of Bassanio, the boy gambler who's lost everything and is relying on Antonio, what does he want? He's pitching his cap at the heiress of Belmont, who seems older, wiser. If you even think of the two gentlemen, Valentine in love with Sylvia, the goddess, who is Sylvia, what is she, that all our swains commend her. Again and again in Shakespeare, in the comedies, we get the feeling that the women are stronger and more mature. They're also quite highly sexed, and they're also reasonably aggressive. When women are sexually straightforward in Shakespeare, it's usually a good thing. If you look at the women in the tragedies, you've got much more, I think, much more a question of defect in understanding. I mean, I think Ophelia's a ditz. You're not supposed to say that, but it's pretty obvious. I don't think Lady Macbeth is all that smart, and in fact she cracks up completely at a time when Macbeth needs her, and so on. So I don't think for Shakespeare it's a problem to think of the young man as sexually aggressive. I think that was an understanding of his culture, certainly an understanding in the ballad literature.
But male biographers or other biographers have looked into his work and found evidence there of a complaint with an older woman, a complaint with a wife.
Yeah, they all use the same thing. They can only find one bit, which is looking really for, you know, a pearl in a dunghill. They find the bit where Orsino says to Cesario that it would be better if he married a woman younger than himself. But does anybody remember the play? Orsino is hardly a sensible fellow. He's not the person we admire. Olivia knows perfectly well she wants the boy and not the man. And in the end, she has to swap the girl, who isn't a boy, for her twin brother, who is. A bit complicated, but you see where I'm going.
Yeah, I do. You go so far as to say that we may actually have Shakespeare because of Anne Hathaway, that she may have financed the publication or helped get out the first publication of his folio after his death.
That's the most daring suggestion, and it's only a suggestion. But I'm just not happy with the accounts of that book. First of all, it was very expensive to produce. Jaggard would have had to be indemnified. We know that the great book collectors of the period didn't collect it. It's not in any of the contemporary collections. It wasn't a success. The success is that it existed. It's one of the least rare books of the period. We've got 27 copies extant of the first folio. They're now worth, of course, billions, sure. But they weren't then. But I think the King's men did not have those plays. They hadn't taken care of them. That is perfectly obvious from their own introduction, that they had to be found. And that's disgraceful. Now, why didn't they have them? Well, you know, I used the analogy of writing for television before. Writing for the stage in the beginning of the 17th century was like writing for television. There were thousands of writers, hundreds, all writing. You know, some wrote the comic scenes, some wrote the tragic scenes, and some wrote pieces for the clowns and so on. So that most plays were team effort. Shakespeare's plays are not, and that in itself is an interesting fact that hasn't been thought about enough. So they were terribly keen on Beaumont and Fletcher. They had a new kind of sentiment. They were fashionable. No theatre wanted to put on plays that were considered unfashionable and obsolete, out of date. So that the number of plays by Shakespeare being produced in the 1620s is minute. And also, by then he has a reputation for being very coarse about sex. Because there's a kind of delicacy has come in with the Stuart setup. So I think to myself, who really needed to feel that all that loneliness, all that suffering, all little Hamnet hankering after his father and not eating, pining, and burying him alone because her husband was away on tour with the company.
Their son, all that needing to be redeemed.
Well, just wanting to think it wasn't for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't find it difficult that she had faith in him as a poet. And this is where, you know, I probably part company totally with my male colleagues because they really need to believe she couldn't read. They want me to read. It's okay, guys. It's okay. She couldn't read. She had no idea she was married to your idol. But she's a Puritan. Her brother's doubly literate. She must have been at least able to read. And what she would have read would have been her Geneva Bible, which is the great Bible with the translations by Tyndale and Coverdale, the really wonderful Bible that was later suppressed by James I, and we got the authorized version instead. But the real key to the Protestantism of Shakespeare's youth is the Geneva Bible. And if you read the Psalms in those versions in the Geneva Bible, you'll realize that a woman who read those every day knew what poetry was, none better.
Right. Jermaine Greer sees not a hag in Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's wife, but a support and maybe his redeemer in getting the work out. The Publishers Weekly describes a hysterical response to your interpretation. You're from a lot of critics in the UK, but it's loud and proud anyway. The book out in the US last year, Shakespeare's Wife, now out in paperback. Jermaine Greer with us from New York. We have so many people who want to speak with you. Let's start to turn to them right now. Brenda Aiken, South Carolina, you're on the air with Jermaine Greer.
Hello, Tom and Dr. Greer. And first, I just want the honor of being spoken to by Dr. Greer. I have been fighting the good fight for 40 years and cannot say that I've accomplished anything. But it is an honor to speak to you and to hear you. From your perspective as someone, a scholar who has looked backward hundreds of years and has who knows where we are today and has looked forward to what we could hope for, taking Anne Hathaway as an example, of someone, a woman who should have enjoyed dignity and honor for who she was and yet has been dismissed and diminished through the centuries. Do you, Dr. Greer, foresee a time when women will fare better than Anne Hathaway has fared at the hands of historians and people of literature, politics?
Well, there's a question as big as it gets. We have 30 seconds before the break. We'll come back and do more. But Jermaine Greer, please begin to take us away.
Yes, I do foresee such a time. It'll be a time when women will lose their own misogyny, when they will be proud of each other, supportive of each other, when they will know how to organize to protect each other's common interest, when they won't identify with the oppressor, when they will identify with each other. And it's coming. It's coming. It's nearer than you think.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with feminist icon Jermaine Greer about her take on William Shakespeare's much-maligned wife Anne Hathaway and her bigger take on the world right now and on women and their place in our world. Almost 40 years after she wrote The Female Eunuch, her book out in paperback now is Shakespeare's Wife. She joins us from New York. Jermaine Greer, Brenda in Aiken had such a big question. You only had a few seconds to get to it. But I wonder if you've got more to say. You said that the main thing to look at here, 400 years on, or 40 in your active time on this, is women's own misogyny?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't surprise me that men are misogynistic. It surprises me that women are so misogynistic. This is less true in America, I think, than it is in Britain, where women instinctively seem to distrust a woman who is making herself prominent at all. When you actually think about the corporate world, for example, would things have been different if there'd been more women in the top tiers of management, in the casino banks and the crooked financial institutions? The evidence seems to be yes. If you think of what happened in the case of Enron, it took a woman employee in senior management who actually saw that the company was virtually a Ponzi scheme and was and actually caused it to fall over, because as long as people go on believing the lie, the corporate structure remains, to the outward eye, completely intact. So and one of the interesting things that's going on is the kind of men's club in which all this happened. Some of the analyses talk about too much testosterone. They talk about wild young Turks in the establishment taking ridiculous risks, trying to outdo each other, competitiveness gone mad. I have always argued that women have a tough time in the corporate world because they are not clubbable. They don't get involved in the conspiracies. They play by the book, and they are naturally punctilious and careful and slow, and their enemies would say timid. Well, right now we need a bit of timidity in the corporate world, I would say. We need a bit of caution. But maybe what we need to do is remake the corporate world altogether, because it's such a masculine paradigm. It's such a phallic entity shaped like a skyscraper.
Does the economic collapse then look like an opportunity to you? There are also maybe setbacks here for both genders.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, every problem is also an opportunity. It offers new possibilities. One of the things that seems to be happening, for example, is that new banks are being founded at community level that will follow the old fundamentalism of, you know, taking in money, lending out money, making sure you don't lend more money than you have, and making sure you don't lend more than the value of the collateral. It's very simple. It's not rocket science. But the whole point about what's happened to our economy is that it became rocket science, and nobody could understand it, not even the people who invented it. And we still haven't snapped out of that. I'm not personally in favor of shoring up a completely rotten system. I think that's going to be very costly, and there are cheaper ways of doing it that would also ease the pain. But we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
We'll talk about what that might be. But Dr. Greer, there's a mountain of listeners who want to speak with you. Megan in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air with Jermaine Greer.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jermaine.
Hi.
I am in a graduate department that is mostly white and male. And then I have students of diverse background, and the women that are my students would be sort of horrified to identify as feminists. And it seems like in terms of misogyny in the men's club, women either want to join the men's club or marry it. So where is, I guess, the future of feminism from an educational standpoint, in your view?
Well, don't give up. I can understand only too well why young women don't want to embrace the creed of their grandmothers. It's like people asking me what advice I have to give to young women. I generally bite my tongue because I think I don't want to discredit what I'm saying because of who it is who's saying it. You know, I'm not fashionable. I get demented when my godchildren, my god-grandchildren, insist on sending me letters in pink and insist on wearing pink and tease me about pink. And I keep saying, don't you realize pink is a vile color? Because they're actually being defiantly feminine with me. We want to be Barbie. Well, they don't really want to be Barbie. It's just a way of rejecting me, if you like. It's like tattooing yourself or whatever is being a way of rejecting the senior female. This strikes me as all part of growing pains. Young people do have to reinvent the wheel. They reinvent their sexuality. They don't want us telling them how to do it, and I can perfectly well see why they wouldn't. So I'm not disheartened by that, because they will eventually realize the shortcomings of their own position. it might be when they had their first baby that they discover just how the situation, just how power is ranged against them. It might be when they break up in a relationship. It might be when they reach menopause. But at some point, there will be a prise de conscience. They will understand suddenly, hey, this world is really unfair to me.
But by that time, aren't they tied up in diapers and everything else? I mean, how do you move forward if the feminist movement needed or needs to, if you've got just a generational swing that wants to be retro? This was a kind of revolution, after all.
I'm not so impatient. You know, everybody mm-hmm. thought that feminism should deliver something. But in fact, we had to deliver feminism first, and we never got that far. We haven't arrived at our own analysis of what sexism really is. We haven't understood whether participation in the masculinist world isn't costing us more. Women's lives are much tougher now than they were before. Women have, we talk about them having it all. What they've got all of is the work. Women don't have leisure. They don't take time off. And the extraordinary thing is so many women are opting out of a marriage and into single parenthood, which means they will literally not have 1 minute of time to themselves until the youngest child is 16 and gone, 20 and gone these days.
Megan in Buffalo, thank you very much for your call. Lee in Boston, you're on the air with Jermaine Greer.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Greer. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. On the note of sexual identity and women, I feel like I'm 22 years old. I think I'll just start with that. And in my experience, what you were talking about before, as far as women defining themselves by their male partners or what their male partners want, I just want to say that I don't feel that that is really my experience on the whole of my life. I feel that a lot of the time, men that I know are looking for women who are sexually empowered, who have a good sort of perspective on their own sexual identity, and who know what they want, and that men are more interested in sort of pleasing women or having a very equal or even exchange. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on that are.
Jermaine
Greer? Well, good.
Unix no good. More?
Good if that's the case. The question of women's sexuality is an interesting one, because one of the first things that had to happen was that women who were lovers of their own sex had to realize that that was a way of being, and a way of being that could be out and proud and so on. The next problem was that it was then predicated on male homosexuality, which it doesn't resemble in any particular. So it was also necessary to try and work out a way of being women together that wasn't already stereotyped in an alien kind of way. All this is interesting and exciting. But the interesting thing is, to me, that women spend still, I would say, at the risk of getting a few angry phone calls, I would still say that the women are much more concerned about what the men are looking for in a woman than the men are in what a woman is looking for in them. That there's a disproportion here, that men give far more importance to their relationship with other men than women do to their relationships with women, that men have developed a way of being together which is stress-free. We sometimes sneer at it and say they never talk about important things. Mm. No, they give each other some time off. They tell jokes. They talk about sport. They go to sport together. If you just look at the enormous importance, economic and otherwise, of male sport, and then see how female sport struggles to keep a foothold. And part of that problem is that women don't want to go and watch women's sport. We don't have crowds of hundreds of thousands of people racing to see, you know, the women's soccer finals or whatever. There's a real difference here. And until women are as interested in each other as men are interested in each other, we're not going to get very far. We're going to be losers at this level.
Lee, are you persuaded? Is there something Jermaine Greer is missing here?
I mean, I think that I totally understand that perspective, and I understand especially how women are very competitive with each other and how we tend to want to cut each other down as opposed to supporting each other. I actually went to an all-girls school my whole life, but to tell you the truth, that kind of community building gave me a better sense of what that should mean in terms of, I think, women supporting each other and women giving sort of everybody that that day off to just be themselves. But I understand. I think that we're still at that point where you know, we need to develop that more. Absolutely.
Lee, well, it's great to hear from you. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Rochelle in Charlottesville.
I would just want to say that please. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more about women being educated together and women-only institutions. That's why I still teach at Newnham College, Cambridge.
Because you think it builds that male-style, easy camaraderie?
It doesn't have to be male style, but it has to be camaraderie. Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is that you can develop all those extra skills that you develop in your tertiary education. You run your own May ball, you know, you mm-hmm. raise your own money, mm-hmm. you play your own sports and so on. And you learn in committee to talk out and to understand how negotiations should go, because you're not being overwhelmed by somebody with a plan of action. Mm. I've talked to young women who've been, for example, the first women who entered Balliol College in Oxford just could never get anywhere because the guys came into all the meetings when they were running the college with a ready-made strategy, which the women were not privy to. So the guys got what they wanted because it had all been worked out, as it were, in the men's room.
Yeah, I don't know.
The same is true in the corporate. Well,
maybe we got some pretty strong young women in this country these days.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I'm Tom.
Yes,
me too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia, and Rochelle. Rochelle, you're on the air with Jermaine Greer.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Greer. Hi. It's a privilege to speak with you, Dr. Greer. Could you please comment on the role of aging for U.S. women, particularly how different generations of women in our country currently perceive themselves and how they're perceived, especially in the workforce, by their male and female peers? I'll tell you, I'm in my mid-50s. I have a daughter who is 30 and a couple sons in their 20s. And I guess as a parent, I and someone in the workforce at this point in my life, I do see a lot of differences in expectations and perceptions.
Well, you know, it happens to us all that as we get older, men accumulate status with gray hair and women lose it. I do find it amazing. I mean, the people call in England, if I, you know, am speaking to a tradesperson, he will call me love. And he will assume that I don't know how to wire a plug and that I don't understand that you have to turn switches on. And he will treat me like an idiot.
And you're an accomplished woman of, what, 70 now? It's not like you haven't been around.
Well, but also I do know how to change a plug. Yeah. I've lived alone all my life.
Right,
I'm
right.
quite good at doing all that. And it's the whole kind of the assumption that people assume, for example, that I wouldn't know how to use a computer. I'm sure there are people who use computers much more effectively than I do. But I can do it, and I will do it, and I'll get better at it, and I'll keep learning, and so on. There will come a moment when I stop learning, but I don't think I've got there yet. And in the corporate world, it is extraordinary, and I can't see how people can't see. You look at the picture of middle management or even senior management, you'll notice that the women are noticeably younger than the men. And you think, well, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. You know, who didn't make it here, and why didn't she make it? We look at the differentials in women's earning power over a lifetime. We now got to look at who's going to be first fired. Well, it's going to be last hired, and the chances are it's going to be female. Ultimately, things have really got to change, but they may have to change in a very laborious way. I mean, women may have to rebuild the labor movement, for example, and they're going to have to stop being grateful to have any kind of a job at all.
Our time is short. May I ask you, and forgive me, but let's look at the politics of this for a second. It's Barack Obama in the White House, not Hillary Clinton, if it was going to be a Democrat this time. What difference does that make to your mind, Jermaine Greer?
Oh, well, it's early days to say. I was a bit shocked last night to hear the commentaries on Obama's performance,
mm-hmm.
on
press
explaining.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in the press conference, that's right. And he was being accused of being arrogant. And I was thinking, because I'm having at the moment to write a piece on Mrs. Thatcher, Mrs. Thatcher was incredibly dismissive of other people. And ironically, she got away with it because she was a woman.
Mm.
And but if you think about Reagan, and even Bush, they were never arrogant. They didn't mind looking foolish. They didn't mind fumbling and bumbling. Obama can't allow himself to fumble or bumble. He's very well aware of what will be done to him. He's already made one mistake in talking about, you know, his own sporting prowess. And I thought, how extraordinary. Why are they perceiving his being rather short with a question from a journalist as a killer arrogance?
Is it because he's not so macho somehow? Maybe even Maggie Thatcher was macho.
No, it's not. I don't think it's that. I think it's to do with the fact that he's perceived as black. He was being uppity. That's what I think. Tricky. I know it's tricky.
I don't know.
The whole thing is really tricky because it's attitudes that you're not quite sure of. Some of the things that were said about Hillary Clinton were disgusting and sexist, and practically everything that was said about Sarah Palin was sexist and nasty.
Yeah, I don't know. Hard to interpret. If you're a cowboy and blunt, maybe it's okay. If you're sophisticated and blunt, maybe it's arrogant. I don't know if it's color or not, but when you speak, we're ready to listen. Jermaine Greer, it's been...
We could talk about it all day.
Yes, we could, and I wish we could, but we can't. It's been great having you with us for this hour. Thanks for Shakespeare's Wife, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.